Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy with Guy Swan. I am your host, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are going to do some reading today. I wanted to hit this one by Parker Lewis. I am currently recording the Bitcoin section of Money, Bitcoin, and Time. But I think so that I don't stretch this out is I'm just going to drop those as full sections. So I'm about 20-ish, somewhere like 25-ish minutes through it right now. But that'll probably be dropping in the next day or two. But today we are going to read another one by Parker Lewis on Unchained Capital with the Gradually Then Suddenly series that he is writing here. And this one is part two, Bitcoin Can't Be Copied. And I just thought this was a really good short one to hit and is super important because so many people fail to understand exactly the nature of the technology and the good that is being created with this system, and how so many of the utility tokens and blockchain services and all this stuff are really missing the point on what the true innovation and what the real value case of this is. And I think this is a really important thing to hit because it'll make you understand, or at least give a really different perspective on what's truly being solved here. What is the real value that this system brings? And why is it that you just can't copy it? So I really like this piece. Like I said before, I've loved this series. So I'm eager to jump into this, and I think we'll have a really fun conversation afterward. But I've got maybe tomorrow. Don't hold your breath, but I think tomorrow I'm going to be dropping the second section, the Bitcoin section of Money, Bitcoin, and Time. Don't hold me to that. It'll be soon. All right, so without further ado, let's jump into Parker Lewis's. Again, this is on Unchained Capital, unchained-capital.com, their blog, and is the Gradually Then Suddenly series, and it's titled, Bitcoin Can't Be Copied. As kids, we all learn that money doesn't grow on trees. As a society, on the other hand, we have become conditioned to believe that it's not only possible, but that it's a normal, necessary, and productive function of our economy. Before Bitcoin, this privilege was reserved to global central banks. See here for an example. Post-Bitcoin, every Tom, Dick, and Harry seems to think that they can create money too. At a root level, this is the audacity of everyone that attempts to create a copy of Bitcoin, whether by hard forking out of consensus, like Bitcoin Cash, cloning Bitcoin, Litecoin, or creating a new protocol with better features, Ethereum. Each is an attempt to create a new form of money. If Bitcoin can do it, why can't we? We sit here in 2019 witnessing the monetization event of an economic good, Bitcoin, on the free market for the first time in thousands of years. Hat tip to gold. Rather than stopping to contemplate the weight of that reality or to understand how or why that is possible, many people skip right past it to focus on some derivative or some way to improve upon a problem they didn't see in the first place. Everyone wants to get rich quick, and so long as there is money, there will also be alchemists. Those that attempt to copy Bitcoin are our modern-day alchemists. They tell us that Bitcoin is too slow, so they create a copy that is, quote, faster. Or they tell us that Bitcoin does not have the capacity to handle the number of transactions required by the global economy, so they create a copy that has a greater scale. Then they tell us that Bitcoin is too volatile to be a currency, so they create a more stable version. It goes on and on. Next, it's that Bitcoin is too rigid and it needs to be more programmable, so they create a copy that is more flexible. They often even tell us that their creation is not money, but instead it's a vehicle for payments, or a utility, or maybe a global computer fueled by gas. They also try to convince us of a world that has hundreds, if not thousands, of currencies. But make no mistake, in each case, it is their own attempt to create money. Bitcoin's value function. If an asset's primary, if not sole, utility is the exchange for other goods and services, and if it does not have a claim on the income stream of a productive asset, such as a stock or bond, it must compete as a form of money and will only store value if it possesses credible monetary properties. With each, quote, feature change, those that attempt to copy Bitcoin signal a failure to understand the properties that make Bitcoin valuable or viable as money. When Bitcoin's software code was released, it wasn't money. To this day, Bitcoin's software code is not money. You can copy the code tomorrow or create your own variant with a new feature, and no one that has adopted Bitcoin as money will treat it as such. Bitcoin has become money over time, only as the Bitcoin network developed emergent properties that did not exist at inception, and which are next to impossible to replicate now that Bitcoin exists. These properties emerged organically and spontaneously as individual economic actors all over the world evaluated Bitcoin and determined to store a portion of their wealth in it. As Bitcoin's value increased, it became decentralized, and as it became decentralized, it also became increasingly difficult to alter the network's consensus rules or to invalidate or prevent otherwise valid transactions, often referred to as censorship resistance. There remains reasonable debate as to whether Bitcoin is sufficiently decentralized or sufficiently censorship resistant. But while this may be the case, there are other considerations less subject to debate. 1. Bitcoin represents, by far, the most decentralized and most censorship-resistant monetary system in the world today, whether compared to traditional currencies, other digital currencies, or commodity monies like gold. 2. Bitcoin derives its value because it is decentralized and because it is censorship-resistant. It is these properties which secure and reinforce the credibility of Bitcoin's fixed 21 million supply. In other words, why it is an effective store of value. 3. Bitcoin becomes increasingly decentralized and increasingly censorship resistant as its value increases and as it scales at all levels of the network. And 4, repeat. Graphic of the circular value of Bitcoin. More miners equals more secure, creates more confidence, leading to more users, leading to a higher price, which leads to more miners, and on and on. Monetary systems tend to one. Every other fiat currency, commodity money, or cryptocurrency is competing for the exact same use case as Bitcoin, whether it is understood or not, and monetary systems tend to a single medium because their utility is liquidity rather than consumption or production. When evaluating monetary networks, it would be irrational to store value in a smaller, less liquid, and less secure network if a larger, more liquid, and more secure network existed as an attainable option. Apply a common sense test. If you worked for 2 weeks and your employer offered to pay you in a form of currency accepted by 1 billion people all over the world, or a currency accepted by 1 million people, which would you take? Would you request 99.9% of one and 0.1% of the other? Or would you take your chances with your billion friends? If you are a U.S. resident, but travel to Europe 1 week a year, do you request your employer pay you 1/52nd in euros each week, or do you take your chances with dollars? The practical reality is that almost all individuals store value in a single monetary asset, not because others do not exist, but rather because it is the most liquid asset within their market economy. Anyone with Venezuelan bolivars or Argentine pesos would opt into the dollar system if they could. And similarly, anyone choosing to speculate in a copy of Bitcoin is making the irrational decision to voluntarily opt into a less liquid, less secure monetary network. While certain monetary networks are larger and more liquid than Bitcoin today, for example, the dollar, euro, and yen, individuals choosing to store a percentage of their wealth in Bitcoin are doing so on average because of the belief that it is more secure. Decentralized leads to censorship resistant, leads to a fixed supply, leads to a store of value. And because of the expectation that others, for example, a billion soon-to-be friends, will also opt in, increasing liquidity and trading partners. Why Bitcoin can't be copied. Many individuals creating digital currencies neither accept nor admit that what they are creating has to be money to succeed. Others that are speculating in these assets fail to understand that monetary systems tend to one medium, or naively believe that their currency can outcompete Bitcoin. None of them can explain how their digital currency of choice becomes more decentralized, more censorship resistant, or develops more liquidity than Bitcoin. To take that further, no other digital currency will likely ever achieve the minimum level of decentralization or censorship resistance required to have a credibly enforced monetary policy. And to literally steal a page from the Bitcoin standard, graphic. How to decide if you need a blockchain. Do you need digital cash? No, you don't need a blockchain. Yes, use Bitcoin, the only blockchain that works. The blockchain decision chart. Bitcoin is valuable not because of a particular feature, but instead because it achieved finite digital scarcity through which it derives its store of value property. The credibility of Bitcoin scarcity and monetary policy only exists because it is decentralized and censorship resistant, which in itself has very little to do with software. In aggregate, this drives incremental adoption and liquidity, which reinforces and strengthens the value of the Bitcoin network. As part of this process, individuals are at the same time opting out of inferior monetary networks. This is fundamentally why the emergent properties in Bitcoin are next to impossible to replicate, and why Bitcoin cannot be copied or outcompeted. Because Bitcoin already exists as an option, and its monetary properties become stronger over time, and with greater scale, while also at the direct expense of inferior monetary networks. One would likely never come to this conclusion without first developing their own understanding of the following. 1. That Bitcoin is finitely scarce. The how and why. 2. That Bitcoin is valuable because it is scarce. And 3. That monetary networks tend to one medium. You may come to different conclusions, but this is the appropriate framework to consider when contemplating whether it is possible to copy or outcompete Bitcoin, rather than a framework based on any particular feature set. It's also important to recognize that any individual's conclusions, including your own or my own, has very little bearing in the equation. Instead, what matters is what the market consensus believes and what it converges on as the most credible long-term store of value. The empirical evidence, the price mechanism and value, demonstrates that the market continues to determine why Bitcoin is different, despite a significant amount of noise. Before speculating, try to understand why Bitcoin works and why it's unique. When someone inevitably tells you about a better Bitcoin or some differentiating feature, remember that the market, which has come to the same crossroad over the last decade before you, has considered those same trade-offs and chosen Bitcoin over the field for very rational reasons. The Minority Rule. Nassim Taleb writes about how a very small, intransigent minority can force its preference on the majority, referring to it as the minority rule and explaining why the most intolerant wins. Bitcoin and monetary systems are a perfect example of this phenomenon. If a very small minority converges on the belief that Bitcoin has superior monetary properties and will not accept your form of digital or traditional currency as money, while less convicted market participants accept both Bitcoin and other currencies, the intolerant minority wins. This is exactly what is happening in the global competition for digital currency supremacy. A small minority of market participants has determined that only Bitcoin is viable, rejecting the monetary properties of all other digital currencies, while the majority is willing to accept Bitcoin along with the field. Because of its intransigence, the minority is slowly forcing its preference on the majority. In the world of digital currencies, diversifying by picking the field is the equivalent of letting the crowd, or the intolerant minority, choose what your future money will be, while resigning yourself to only a fraction of what you otherwise would have saved. Evaluate the trade-offs and consider the minority rule before trading in your hard-earned value for a flyer. Money doesn't grow on trees. Quote, Bitcoin is a remarkable cryptographic achievement, and the ability to create something that is not duplicable in the digital world has enormous value. End quote. Eric Schmidt, former CEO of Google. Next week, Bitcoin is not too volatile to be a currency. And that concludes Parker Lewis's Bitcoin Cannot Be Copied. I really, really love this piece, and it hits a couple of things. I love the focus on the minority rule, and there's a lot of things I want to talk about. I really want to kind of get into this for 10 or 15 minutes if I can. I'm a little low on time, but let's go ahead and hit our sponsor. I got to get something to drink because I am parched at the moment, and I will come back, and we will hit some fun commentary on this piece. All right. So let's break down a little bit of Parker Lewis's excellent, excellent piece here. Bitcoin cannot be copied. So I love the stipulation, like towards the beginning, that just monetary goods are extremely specific because their dominant function is simply to be the most liquid good for an exchange medium. Its dominant function is for a medium of exchange. So we talked about this in Money, Bitcoin, and Time, which we've just covered three parts of the first money section. And the use case for money is in obtaining salability across scales so that, you know, you can add as many together as you want or break it down into the tiniest of fractions, and it is still the same good. It's still multiples of the same good or fractions of the same good, and it is worth proportionally, then salability across space, that it doesn't matter where you are, one unit of Bitcoin is still one unit of Bitcoin. It's completely arbitrary. Whereas the example used in Money, Bitcoin, and Time was something like that a coal mine in Colorado is not also a coal mine in Missouri. It's stuck in Colorado, so it does not have salability across space. And then obviously salability across time, that one unit of the good today is the exact same unit and has not changed quantitatively or qualitatively over the elapsed time. Like in a year, it's the exact same good, it's the exact same quality, it's not any different. And in achieving these characteristics, As well as being the most liquid good in the economy, it becomes the only good that can solve the double coincidence of wants problem. And that's where, when we talk about the double coincidence of wants, if you don't know, we talked about all this in the money piece, is just that I have something that you want. Like, if we, you know, like everybody played Zelda back in the day where the guy's like, oh yeah, I'll give you some milk. You just have to go find me two chickens. Like, like if I can give you money, well, then you can just trade somebody else to do the chickens. I don't have to come up with exactly what everybody wants at any specific time. We can use money to solve that problem, the double coincidence of wants problem. So the more supposed monies that we have competing in this playing field, the less any one of them is solving that problem. It leaves the problem unsolved, which means that there's huge inefficiency, there's huge cost and barriers to trade. Like, if I have to trade to get some blue tokens to trade with you, but then I got to get green tokens to trade with Starbucks, well, we're back to some bizarre virtual barter system where we're trading things that are meaningless. So it's very similar to having to go find the shoemaker some eggs in order to just buy some shoes. So because of this, money tends to one. It's the nature of money. And it's because only a single dominant money can satisfy the problem that money is meant to solve. And every altcoin, no matter what they call it or what they say it's for smart contracts or it's for DNS or for blah, 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 it is competing to be money because it's attempting to be a token good whose sole purpose is to be exchanged for some service or a process within the network. That's what they're trying to do with a utility token. So when that service or product is not attached to the use of the particular good for exchange, then there's no reason to be using, if a blockchain offers notary services that are only for blue tokens, I'm still going to be able to get notary services for dollars. It's why would I first get blue tokens when what I am seeking is a notary service? So this is such an important point, and I cannot stress it enough, that the main function of money is just to be a reliable medium of exchange for other goods and services. So when we're talking about digital money, when we're talking about money as software, we are specifically talking about things that genuinely cannot fulfill another task. They are just exchangeable digital tokens. So it's either money or you don't need it. You can't build a skyscraper out of digital points. You can't start a fire with them. Nothing. Really, all you can do is own and exchange them, which means the one purpose that they can fulfill is money. That's both what makes Bitcoin the most pure form of money that has ever existed, and why at the same time it can't be copied. It explains why this is a 0-to-1 invention that now simply has to prove itself as having those characteristics of an honest money. So that's really important. I think Parker Lewis did a great job of breaking down that concept, and it's something that is so hard to stress, and it's so hard to get your head around it. You don't see, it's so difficult to then, it's a very long process to see that story. But another part of it that I really, really enjoyed in this article, which he does a great job of clearing, essentially, is that the software isn't money. The code itself is not the money. And this one is something that you really only get with a extensive history of money. It's so interesting that the history and study of money explains Bitcoin far better than even the basic economics, the basic incentive structure, and the technology do. I really think money, understanding what money is, the history of money, how it comes about, what it looks like when monies are competing, I think that is the most critical piece of the puzzle to understanding the rest of it. And then the incentive structure makes amazing sense and is brilliant. And it's brilliant one way or the other, but it's even more brilliant when you realize it's used to obtain or create a monetary good. And same with the technological side of it, like all the other pieces suddenly have an incredible purpose, and you see how important it is that all of the pieces work exactly like they do. And it explains or enlightens to the fact that the process of monetization is a long one. It is a process of maturation, and it has to prove itself on multiple fronts in order to do this. So when Bitcoin first came into existence, there was no security in its 21 million limit of supply. It was just software running on a couple of computers. Even if all the code of today's implementation was re-implemented back in 2009 in exactly the same way, with all the exact same code that my node is running right now, it would still not have been any more secure. It still would have been, the 21 million supply would have been up in the air. All of its characteristics would have been completely insecure. It is through the growth of the network, it's through the expansion and distribution of the number of validators, it's in the bridging of all the jurisdictions, the recognizability from a large number of cultures and demographics, the many tests, the conflicts through which Bitcoin has survived, and the growth of the intolerant minority that have granted the properties of money to this thing we call Bitcoin. It is only through the history and the growth of the 10 years that it has slowly become a monetary good, that it has achieved and earned security, that it has created stability in its 21 million limit. And these are the properties and the test which no other altcoin has ever met. Or many have tested and been tested and failed. Copying the code does not copy the meaningful properties of Bitcoin, because it is a living system and it acquires these properties because it has a DNA that creates an incentive structure so that it grows in a specific direction, that it tends toward achieving these monetary properties over time. And that's such a fascinating way to illustrate the difference between Bitcoin and an absolute perfect copy of Bitcoin of the software that, you know, simply adjusts a decimal point or just calls itself a different token. That new one does not have any censorship resistance. It's not decentralized. It's got no security in its monetary properties, and therefore it doesn't have any security at all. It'll take years for these things to develop, while a good that already has them, Bitcoin, and has the exact same DNA proving earning its security, improving its security over time, is competing directly with it. It is a winner-take-all environment where the thing that even has a perfect copy of the code has none of the earned properties of Bitcoin. And I hadn't articulated it quite the same way as he does in this piece, or I hadn't even explained it to myself in quite the same way, but it's such a clear connection to make in retrospect that the 21 million supply is completely arbitrary if the system is not decentralized and censorship resistant. Anything that compromises Bitcoin's independence, anything that says, like, to compromise its independence means that there are any subjective judgments of the data being processed in this network outside of the system's rules. We're talking about that nothing external to the system can apply in the validation process. So anything that does compromises every last rule of the system. As soon as something external to the system applies in validation, then none of the rules matter within the system. That's why Ethereum has essentially failed this test. The DAO, the DAO, proved that the system is not independent or censorship resistant, which means nothing about the system is anything but normal, editable software code. That's a really important distinction that I hadn't considered directly. It's one of those things that's like kind of always sitting in your left hand while you're doing everything with your right hand. It's like, you know it's there, but you can't quite define it. And that's such a great way to put it, that without the decentralization, without the censorship resistance, which are things that are acquired slowly over time in a maturation process, everything else about the software system is arbitrary. It can be changed just like any code on any computer. These properties are derivatives of each other. You know, all the consensus rules are secured because of broad decentralization. So this is why you will hear so many Bitcoin maximalists say that the greatest feature of Bitcoin is that we can't change it. That even something as seemingly trivial as the block size limit fails to break the effect of a decentralized shelling point. That's what makes Bitcoin powerful. That's not what makes it unable to, increase its feature set or be applied to more things. That's what makes it saleable across all of the spheres, and it's what makes it socially scalable. It's what makes it a global money where no single demographic, no single community, no single political system or tendency has any control of this over the system, and therefore everyone can use it together. That's what makes it a global decentralized system. So if Bitcoin loses its decentralization, if it loses that independence, censorship resistance, then it can be easily changed, and all of its other monetary properties go with it. If it cannot store value as a scarce asset, then it can't serve any of the other functions of money either. And then lastly, the minority rule. This is something that I don't think I've really talked about a lot on this show, and it really deserves... In fact, I've mentioned Nassim Taleb's Skin in the Game book a number of times, and I don't even think I have it on the Bitcoin Survivors book list. I really should go ahead and put it on there, because I really do talk about it all the time. And it's such an important concept. The whole skin in the game, the incentive structure, it's really critical to the whole game theory of everything about Bitcoin and just the system in general. But the intolerant minority, the minority rule is that an strictly intolerant minority will win over essentially a complacent or a general majority. And Bitcoin maximalists could not be a better manifestation of this concept. In embracing the nature of money and seeing Bitcoin as a tool for money exclusively, all the other alts just become the yelling rants of alchemists. That's why they see and rightfully warn of everything else as a scam. And it doesn't have to be consciously admitted for the alt corner to say that this is a money grab or that they're competing with money. It doesn't matter what they call it, what they say it's for. If it's an exchangeable digital good that's attempting to be exchanged for goods and services, it's competing as a money. So, like, I have to admit, I'll be completely honest, I spent a lot of time considering launching my own shitcoin because people were making an insane amount of money doing so. But I legitimately couldn't come up with an honest reason why. Like, Richard Hart made his own token, I think, even, and it was not too long after he got really butthurt during the, no shade on him, but... I had a breakdown on YouTube about the bear market and how bad everything was crashing and how he didn't want to have to hold through a whole nother bear market and it's miserable, which it is, completely understand. Like, I was feeling every feeling that he was going through in that video. So I understood it. And like, but I knew like anything underlying anything that I attempted to excuse about altcoins or shitcoins or utility coins was simply me seeing how much money other people were making. And obviously, I wanted to be making that money too. But it was all just an elaborate excuse to justify what that was. What I really wanted was that I wanted a bunch of tokens I could sell for Bitcoin. Every altcoin I ever held during the altcoin casino of 2017 was held for that purpose because I wanted to get more Bitcoin. And that's so true that that's a kind of a meme on Twitter, but it's the freaking truth. Everybody played the altcoin game because they were going to make more Bitcoin. And people, all the people who are in altcoins right now, they're not even watching the dollar price. They're watching how much they're losing in Bitcoin. And 99% of them traded their Bitcoin for these altcoins. Bitcoin is the money of the crypto economy. And it's because of that reference, because everybody is watching those prices specifically fall, that Bitcoin is the shelling point, even for the people who claim so desperately that they hate it or think that it's a terrible money. It's the money of the crypto economy. So I had not actually read Nassim's book in a while. It's been quite some time. I've obviously been busy reading other stuff. But I just forgot how clear that logic of the principle was. So I really appreciate Parker Lewis's simplification of it, just as kind of a refresher, because it's such a simple idea, but it's not entirely obvious when you first think about it. But if Group A is willing to accept dollars, green tokens, and Bitcoin for exchange, and you know, is at the same time claiming everybody should get along and we should all work together, that this isn't a competition, and then Group B accepts dollars, blue tokens, and Bitcoin, and similarly wants everyone to be a unified ecosystem where we all can participate together. But Group C sees everything else as a scam, will only ever hold any of it for the exact amount of time that it takes to turn it into Bitcoin, and then demands only Bitcoin. Bitcoin wins by default. There is no scenario where the green or blue tokens come out ahead. And if like a blue tokener or a green tokener attempts to be as intolerant as Bitcoiners are, well, then they lose even faster because of the chasm between their monetary properties in competition with each other, which again mature slowly as a characteristic of a growing network in the distribution of its you know, digital foundation and the defensibility of those rules. You're not merely born from having similar code. I need an analogy for this. It's like having the exact same DNA and the instructions to build an axe and to say that, you know, we're going to grow a human who will eventually be able to cut down a tree for you. But one is still in the womb, and the other is fully grown and has already made an axe. So, yes, the instructions are identical, but only one of the two can actually get the job done, and the former may never make it out of the womb. So, we've already got one that does the job and has earned all of the attributes that prove it can do so. That's kind of a weird analogy, but I like it. I think it applies and shows or demonstrates that it is a maturation process. Just because you have all the code for a human doesn't mean you have a human that can do the job yet. I guess we'll close that episode on the weird analogy. A huge thank you to Parker Lewis for this series. I've been loving this, and so happy that I'm able to read it on the show because it just makes me rant about crap like this. So do not forget to check out the blog and the other amazing writing that they've got over at unchained-capital.com. Where is it? .org. Man, I never know. There's so many dot things these days. Where is my browser? .com. Unchained-capital.com. Okay. And don't forget that we have a lot of other stuff coming soon. We'll be hitting the next section of Money, Bitcoin, and Time very close on the horizon. So stay tuned for that. Subscribe and follow me on Twitter. I am at The Crypto Economy, and this is the Crypto Economy Podcast with Guy Swan. It is so important that we understand this stuff so that, you know, we can traverse the crypto economy safely. And I genuinely don't see a future where this is not a huge part of our lives. So I can't imagine, I don't know of a better way to be informed then read about every possible aspect of the system, its nature, the economy that's going to be growing from it, the technology, its history, everything else from a huge collection of the most brilliant minds in the space. But the second best way to do it is by listening to all of those on the crypto economy. So thanks, guys. If you want to support the show, please consider becoming a patron. Just $5 a month, and you can help make sure that everything you ever wanted to read about Bitcoin is available for you right here in audio, read with the beautiful voice of Guy Swan. Plus, you'll get access to the Crypto Economy Telegram group, where we talk about all kinds of crazy stuff, and you'll get an inside look into other things I'm working on. I got some stuff, fun stuff coming out, secret projects that I don't tell you normies about. But if you can't swing that, if you can't be a patron just yet, simply sharing this show with like two friends is a massive way to support what I'm doing. And I thank everyone who helps me get this show out there. I see you people sharing and liking and reviewing and stuff, and I don't thank you enough. Thank you. Thank you. I love you guys. I will catch you all back here tomorrow. And until then, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.